here. This is Mike.
And this is Andrew.
And this is Comparing Apples to Oranges podcast, where we take two things that are in the same category that don't belong in the same genre, and using a series of criteria we come up with ahead of time, rank them to decide which one is better. This is Andrew's first time on this podcast, so this is like his inaugural voyage. We're going to break a little champagne bottle on him.
It's my first time on any podcast.
Oh, so. Well, let me tell you, this is going to skyrocket you right to the top of the Apple Google Play Store.
That's good. I didn't know.
I think they call that reach. Is that the medical term these days? Your digital footprint? Is that a phrase?
Yes.
I'm all over it, man. All right. So we're going to look at music documentaries today. This is Andrew's suggestion. I just found out he has never listened to a single episode of this podcast, so this is going to be kind of interesting for both of us. Andrew picked this, and he also picked one of the
documentaries
that we wanted to watch. So, Andrew, what do you like music documentaries? Have you watched a bunch of them before?
No, not particularly. I do like documentary films in general, though.
Okay.
And the film I picked is an older documentary film.
The 80s.
Yeah, 1984. So we're 34 years
right.
Since this came out. But I had always heard very good things about this film, and it was actually directed by someone who is well known for mainstream movies, and it's just a movie I had always wanted to see.
I also like documentaries a lot. With the explosion of Netflix streaming's capabilities of just like everything and anything will show up on there, and you gotta watch out, because then you'll watch something about child slavery or the cocaine epidemic. Or you could watch something that, you don't want to eat meat anymore. So you got to be careful with the documentaries you watch. I tried to watch one about the truth behind alcohol's effects, but it turned out to just be sort of like an extended UK Mythbusters episode where they just sort of did experiments with people getting drunk. And, I mean, it had 3 stars. That's Netflix is hard. Those algorithms, you gotta watch out sometimes. But as music documentaries go, I don't think... The only one I could come up with off the top of my head was This is Spinal Tap, which is, of course, not real. But that was, like, the first one I thought of, so I didn't really know what to expect when we watched either of these. But the good news is that both of them were on a list, like, top music documentaries you should see, which means that, like, I guess...
And that surprises me with respect to your choice.
There's a lot of stuff out there that must not be very... I mean, like, every single band... that has other occult following or like is on their, has more than one tour or just has access to like a video camera now can have a documentary in, just an extended music video if they want it to be. But, there's the famous ones like the Rolling Stones or like they had stuff from like Woodstock, I'm not really interested in that, especially like Woodstock 99. That would just be a train wreck of a whole situation to have to, put ourselves through that. So Andrew picked Stop Making Sense, which is a concert documentary from 1984 by the Talking Heads. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I didn't know anything about the documentary, like I said, other than the band that it was about, the Talking Heads, and that it was directed by Jonathan Demme. I believe that's how you say his last name, who...
He'll probably call us.
Well, he's dead, so no.
Oh, God. His estate will probably call us.
He cannot call us.
Nice try, Johnny.
But he also directed Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia were some of the more popular films and ones I liked as well. And I also have an affinity for the Talking Heads. I've always enjoyed their music. Never been a diehard fan, mostly because they... predated my adolescence,
right?
Always enjoyed them and was always very intrigued by it. So this is a concert documentary, but not what you would traditionally think of. I think at the time it was probably perceived as avant-garde, and I would say it probably if it came out today it still would be.
It seems pretty fresh, like in that capacity too. It didn't seem dated except for their bass's hair. That was the only thing.
Yeah, the film quality, and I know that be better today, but
hopefully
yeah.
Or maybe somebody would put a filter on it just to make it look like that.
Yeah.
So and then I picked Jimi Hendrix's or Jimi Hendrix Voodoo Child, which turns out was a streaming or Netflix exclusive documentary.
And came out in 2010.
Of course, posthumously. But so this one was interesting because it was, so it's produced by his estate. So it got, you know, the official stamp. It wasn't, you know, just a bunch of tabloids or whatever. They had full access to all of his letters that he wrote. It seemed like he wrote most of them to his father, who sort of raised him. It's like the story of Jimi Hendrix by Jimi Hendrix. It's pretty interesting in the capacity that everything seemed to be at a deeper level. Like, you're getting his perspective of things, but it kept almost... It produced nothing from a third-person perspective. There was no objective. It was all, like, Jimi Hendrix. Him talking on at concerts, him talking on TV shows, like, interviews, reading stuff that he was quoted as saying. And it's all voiced by Bootsy Collins, who I... He didn't really sound too much like Jimi Hendrix from the videos we saw, but it's still interesting to have, like, somebody read that stuff, and I guess they got somebody who was close to it.
Yeah, the structure was supposed to be the documentary of Jimi Hendrix as told by Jimi Hendrix.
Right. It's like him starting out as, like, a poor guy.
Yeah, and it starts out with his childhood and goes through pretty much his entire life up until his untimely death in 1970. So it covers, and well, as I'll describe from what I liked or didn't like in this case, is that it kind of touches on everything and doesn't really get any depth on anything.
Right. And this is sort of, you know, what we have of these artists back then, because they're, you know, they weren't constantly being hounded by social media or TMZ, or that, you know, they weren't also, like, posting stuff on blogs or their Facebook page. So this is as intimate a look as we could have gotten, which, you know, is sort of what you expect from a documentary. But you also expect there to be, like, behind the music where it's talking and then there's, like, a lightning bolt, or, like, they change the frame and then flip it into the negative and it's like, here's the story behind the story. And we didn't get that really in this, and I thought it was a novel approach to fairly, I don't know if I would say he's controversial, because it was just like back in the 60s and 70s, everybody's sort of like, if you didn't wear a tie you were sort of controversial, and he was just sort of a really important figure of the whole, you know, psychedelic movement too, and rock and roll movement at the time. So it was interesting to hear his take on what he was becoming and what his, like, social cultural role was from his perspective.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, that's true too. These movies came out, one was in 1984, one was in 2010. I don't even know. Are there, like, genres of either of these besides the ones that we actually watch? Like, a music documentary, I was expecting more. Neither of these fit comfortably into it. Like,
yeah.
An extended, like a concert documentary, I've seen those before where it's just like a concert.
Mm-hmm.
But that, what this was, Stop Making Sense was filmed over three concerts.
Over three nights at the same venue.
Which kind of explains, like, how David Byrne was able to jog constantly. Like, he tries to dance, and this poor guy, he's real scrawny. Do you know who Cillian Murphy is?
I do.
He looks a lot like him. Like,
and I think he's taller though.
Okay, he's... He wasn't standing next to like a ruler. I couldn't figure out.
I'm pretty sure David Byrne is kind of tall, and I don't know. I just get the perception that Cillian Murphy's a shorter guy.
So imagine Cillian Murphy with really high shoes, and like he tries to dance with his like backup singers a little bit, and that's, he's doing his best, you know. And then he just jogs for some of the set. He just like runs in place and then he'll just jog around. This guy has so much energy.
These performances, needless to say, if you're going to watch this, you will learn that it is intense.
Yeah.
And it almost looks like everyone in the band just like ran a marathon at the end of it, because they are sweating so much by the end of this.
But it seems like the energy back and forth from the, like, the audience was into it.
But one of the interesting things about this is you don't really see the audience
at all. Like, it could presumably be an empty auditorium. Yeah. Like,
in the documentary starts, or the concert starts, with like an empty soundstage,
right,
and it builds both in band members who mm-hmm. keep joining, but also pieces of the set,
which was super interesting concept. Also, yeah, it starts with Cillian Murphy,
David Byrne
coming out with a like a ghetto blaster of a boombox, and he's just like, "I want to play you a song," and presumably his band would also play the instruments to the song that he's playing the tape of. But he starts off with Psycho Killer, which I'm not completely familiar with their catalog. I don't know if that was a huge hit when they were going on, but my brief Wikipedia dive into the Talking Heads said that this movie came out at the height of their popularity, and they ended up tragically breaking up in like 91. So this is, you know, they were sort of riding high in between this movie and before it too. So that's pretty, you know.
Yeah, and after I watched this, I mean, knowing a little bit about the Talking Heads backstory, but not really anything significant.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of stuff about their breakup and then recent attempts to get the band back together.
Right.
And needless to say, they do not like each other. Or at least they do not like David Byrne,
right,
the other three band members.
It sounded like they had started the band, the original members started back in like...
It was in like 75.
They lived in a loft together,
yeah,
and
New
they
York
started
City.
A band. That's a long time to be a band.
This is at the height of their popularity.
Top of the wave.
But also, I think what the movie does really well is it conveys really who they are and mm-hmm. who they were in the band, too. Is David Byrne is this kind of creative, artistic genius. And I think all of them would admit that, but I think they would also say he was probably an asshole too. And you could probably tell watching this, like, that guy, he's really good. He's got a really neat voice, might be a huge asshole.
Right, yeah. He's like, this is what we're going to do, and I'm going to have the biggest suit.
Yeah. he wears a suit that gets bigger and bigger over the course of the movie until it's outrageously big at the end.
And he said it was inspired by Japanese theater. Not the kabuki, which is the only one I know, but it's called... It was N-O-H. I presume that's pronounced no. I have no idea. Yeah. Don't speak Japanese. But apparently, that's like, you know, when they have like the outlandish costumes and like larger than life because they're on stage. So he sort of... And I don't know if you caught it. There was like a credit in the ending credits of this person helped design Mr. Burns' suit. Like very large suits.
No, but yeah, so it's really cool and interspersed with shots of I think the movie was supposed to be kind of a countercultural take on MTV, the rise of MTV and music videos at the time. So they were really trying to do something different. And so lots of close-ups on their faces, not really of them in their instruments.
Yeah, it was like super intimate with that. So they describe, according to Wikipedia, they describe Talking Heads as an American rock band formed in 1975 in New York City. And then it's later, the group helped to pioneer new wave music by integrating elements of punk, art rock, funk, and world music with avant-garde sensibilities and an anxious, clean-cut image. I don't know what, there's a lot of words in there. Like... I think, like, when they say world music, they just mean, like, African music, right? Because, like, three of the members came from other Parliament Funkadelic, or they said some of the backup, Lynn Marbury, originally of the Brides of Funkenstein. Man, they just had better names for bands. What we got now? Like, Creed? Imagine Dragons? That's a dumb name. Yeah. Brides of Funkenstein, okay?
Yeah.
They just worked harder back then.
Yeah, I think they did. And the singers who I think you're referencing they were backup vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't actually, I don't think they were official members of the Talking Heads.
Just for this tour?
Yeah, I don't know if they were just there for the tour, but they were great too. I mean, they they really make the sound resonate. And David Byrne, because I think he pretty much did all of the vocals.
There was like one song when he like went and like they toweled him off. And,
well, that was
and
that's
the, and it, the lady bassist took over.
Yeah, yeah, that that was part of. That's also a different group too, because the bassist and the drummer are married and have been married for a really long
time.
No
way.
That's their band. Mm-hmm. When they played in the middle of the.
Oh, that's interesting.
In the middle of the. That's why he kind of. David Byrne kind of gave them the spotlight for just a minute.
Yeah.
And then he came out with an even bigger suit and took it back. It was like, you could have it for a second.
I will show you what's up.
And that their band is the Tom Tom Club. So.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. All right. So, and then let's talk about Jimi Hendrix a little bit. It's sort of, it was interesting. I think he called himself the Black Elvis at some point, which was sort of, that's like not derogatory, right? To call yourself the Black Elvis. I don't know where that is.
Yeah.
Because Elvis pioneered blues music for white people with, I don't know. There's a lot of layers there.
Yeah.
I also didn't know that Jimi Hendrix was originally from like Omaha.
No, he's from Washington, wasn't he? He's from like Seattle or he's the Pacific Northwest, I thought.
Yeah.
I think he's from the Pacific Northwest, which...
yeah, you're right. Seattle, Washington.
Yeah, and he, I think that kind of, I don't know. I had to read a lot into some of the things he said because my big takeaway is how could a documentary told in the words of Jimi Hendrix himself be so boring? But my God, some of the stuff in this movie is just boring.
Yeah. It's a lot of concert footage and then like I said before, talk show appearances, postcards to his dad sort of over like, be real of just like the towns that he was in, and then like apparently he was in he was like a paratrooper, which I didn't know, and then
I didn't know that either.
Read something I totally didn't know about. It said Hendrix talked about how he didn't like the army later, and he said that he received a medical discharge after breaking his ankle, and it turns out that that's not true. His captain filed a report that he had had behavior problems. He requires excessive supervision while on duty. Has little regard for regulations. He was also apprehended masturbating in the platoon area while supposed to be on detail. So he received an honorable discharge on the basis of unsuitability, which is like, I get like good because this is right before Vietnam and they like had the draft. So he would have gotten like court-martialed for like.
Yeah, he
or
was
dishonorably discharged.
He was never deployed.
Right.
I think he was only in the army for what, like a year.
Right.
I think, yeah. So he was trained as a paratrooper, but I think he even mentioned in some of his whatever either was diary,
right,
or the postcards. Or postcards that he was writing that he began to like go off base and play at a lot as many shows as he could while he was in the
right.
army.
Which, if I know anything about the military, they're totally fine with you doing whatever you want. They're absent with leave. I'm pretty sure is the phrase they love bandying about. No, yeah. Also, like you just look at him and he's like, I want to play the guitar. You're like, boy, you were in the wrong business. So you got to get out of the paratroopers.
And he did.
Yeah. But. Just had to jerk it off a couple times, and then they're like, you know what? Here's an honorable discharge. Thank you for your service.
Yeah. But to make my point a little clearer, like, he says some things where it's just like, let's just talk about that for... I just want to know more about that for the next half hour. It's like, yeah, I was young. I was stoned with Bob Dylan. It's like, tell me more.
Right.
And then it's like, nothing. It's like, on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was an instrumentalist for Little Richard.
Right.
But it was kind of boring, so I left. And it's like...
He played with Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
He was with the Isley Brothers.
Just
these people
like,
were huge at the time.
And he was just kind of this throwaway. Like, I was bored. And so I left.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
And then he was talking about how he started playing the guitar with his teeth, which apparently he says is common in Tennessee because they're just wild there and you need to do something to impress them. I don't know anything about Tennessee that would, you know, merit playing the guitar with my teeth to appease a crowd. But if he says it, I assume he was telling the truth. But yeah, so he had that trick, and then he talked about, like, when he lit the guitar on fire, he's like, no, it just made a lot of sense.
Yeah,
and I'm like...
I remember that he says, He said he burns his guitar because you sacrifice the things you love.
Like his teeth.
I don't understand what that means. But
it's
okay.
You're not a rock guy. That's,
I know,
Andrew.
I'm not rock and roll, apparently.
All right. So we talked about both movies, the genres a little bit. So now we're going to jump into the categories so you could so we could decide which one is the better music documentary. Okay, we're back. We're discussing music documentaries, and we're going to discuss the four criteria that we're going to use to determine which music documentary was better: the Talking Heads' Stop Making Sense or Jimi Hendrix' Voodoo Child. With all movies, we always talk about rewatchability or recommendability. So which one of these documentaries would you rewatch, maybe to catch something more that you didn't get the first time, or which one would you recommend to somebody who's never seen either? Just to be like, hey, this is a really good movie, really good music documentary. That's our first criteria. Our second one is, which documentary did you learn the most from? So I typically pick up a documentary so that I can find out more about a certain topic or subject or person, because I am really interested in that person and I want to find out like the behind the scenes, or you know, what really happened. And typically a documentary does a good job of just providing a bunch of information that you can't get as a normal fan. So what do you think about those two to start with?
Well, as far as rewatchability...
Don't tell me which one yet. Just tell me what you think about that as a documentary. Like, do you rewatch a lot of documentaries, or do you recommend
I have watched, rewatched a couple documentaries... certain ones about politics that interest me a great deal, more than once or more than twice. And if it's on, I would probably sit down and watch it again.
Okay.
But it's documentaries aren't, they're just not on as much, right? HBO doesn't show them 50 times.
Right.
Like, I've seen
A&E.
Yeah.
The CW.
Yeah.
Isn't cranking out those.
But there was this one documentary on Showtime about Dick Cheney that I found incredibly fascinating. Every time it was on, I had to watch it because I just could not believe the things that were in there, and I could not believe they were true.
Did it have a hilarious name just because his name's Dick Cheney?
I can't remember.
No. It's like...
I think it was maybe The World According to Dick Cheney, but I don't...
That's not bad. It's just not that creative.
Yeah. And then another political documentary I've watched more than once called The War Room, which was about Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign. And basically, George Stephanopoulos and Carville are the two real characters in that documentary. And I've seen that multiple times as well.
I think that is a good segue for our next criteria, which you came up with, was... the storytelling quality, sort of like the narrative that the documentary weaves, because the idea behind a documentary isn't that it's just like a fixed camera that's just sort of catching what's going on, but it's through editing and through a director, you know, or multiple filmmakers, that you're getting a story from this. Like, you're getting inside the subject's head, or you're getting details that paint a fuller picture for give you motive, or that explain things, or they provide context that you don't just get from what actually happened. Or in the case of like both of these, you're sort of like in a concert, you're going to see like the narrative that David Byrne wanted to see or wanted to display. And then with Jimi Hendrix, we're going to get the story that of his life from his perspective. So I thought that was a really intuitive one. Why did you think this was a good criteria for a documentary, let alone a music documentary?
Documentaries can and should have, you know, a beginning, a middle, and end. They should have an arc to whatever they're trying to say. It doesn't necessarily have to be a point. It could be to entertain, to
right.
keep people in suspense. To, I think by the very definition of a documentary, perhaps you can't have a fictitious documentary, but there are some that certainly push the boundaries and can be just as interesting, engaging, and on the edge of your seat as any movie you've ever seen too.
Right. I remember watching. So the movie City of God was really popular.
About the Brazilian favelas,
right? And then
which was almost like a it felt like a documentary, but you know, obviously not
exactly. But off the heels of that, they made a documentary called, I want to say it's City of Ghosts, and it takes place in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and it follows these two like warlord brothers and a woman who was working for the Red Cross. And it's sort of like, I think they're like 19, the brothers are, and it's like, it's just a documentary about like how brutal life is there, but then you're like sort of swept up in their like charisma. And then the woman who is with the Red Cross ends up having like a love triangle issue with the brothers, and you're just like, is this real? Like, it was like edge of your seat, like you're talking about suspense, character development, like arc. You're just like, what's going on?
Yeah, they're small tangents. Mm-hmm. There's a documentary film festival in Columbia, Missouri that takes place every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to live in Columbia, Missouri.
What's it called for all the...
It's called the True False Film Festival.
All the non-Missourians that listen to this.
And it is actually, it's one of the coolest things that happens in Missouri.
It's nationally like renowned too.
Yeah, it's exclusively documentary films. And 2 years ago when I was attending the festival, you might have seen this documentary. It was called Tickled. And it was about this Australian journalist who tried to uncover the world of competitive tickling, but through his coverage learned of a deeper tickling conspiracy. I'll leave you on the edge of your seat there, but it's one of the best, most recent documentaries I've seen that was very, very good. And so this was one of the first film festivals, True False, where this was being aired,
right,
or were shown.
Right.
One of the persons who became the subject of the documentary was going around every place that this was being shown,
right,
and suing this person.
Oh my God.
And filing like TROs to try to prevent them from showing it. And
for libel?
For like defamation. Okay. And so there were people who were spies in the showing trying to record it. And so because it's a film festival, the journalist was there after the showing.
Uh-huh.
And was like, yeah, I just got served with a lawsuit at this showing that was yesterday afternoon. And is there anyone here? I'm sure there's spies here trying to illegally record,
right,
this. And then he like pointed at it, was like, I'm in the story. And like, this is the craziest thing.
That's like, a movie that's 4D. Yeah. You know, when like you get spritzed with water, yeah, when like somebody sneezes, you're like, I'm part of the movie.
And now you're part of the movie. But then he announced to us that he didn't really care because he had just sold the distribution rights to HBO. And he's like, they have like 250 attorneys who are now like countersuing. So it was just hilarious.
Well, I'm glad he's not going to be bankrupt now. Yeah. I don't know if he's going to make any money, but I really want to see this movie now.
You got to watch Tickled.
All right. Is it? Oh, HBO. Okay, so it's going to be available soon. Not streaming on Netflix.
It did air on HBO already.
Okay,
but yeah, I'm sure that you can still see it.
And then our last criteria that we're going to talk about is, which documentary made you want to revisit either the story of the artist or band or the music of the artist and band? Because I think a good documentary, it sort of fleshes out how the music was created or how an album was created, or just gives you insights that make you want to revisit something that you've known for so long. Or in sort of our case, like I knew both of these artists have like a very strong following and they have a very well-known catalog. And I was familiar with, I think, you know, the hits. I wasn't, you know, I didn't really go too deep into either of these guys. I think I have a greatest hits of Jimi Hendrix, and it turns out I knew like 10 of the songs from Talking Heads when I really only thought I knew 3 of, you know, by them. And so like, which one would I want to go back to and just check out more? Because I think a documentary is supposed to not just like give you the full picture, just sort of like whet your appetite or, you know, push you in the right direction to look for more questions. All right. So you ready to talk about, let's talk about rewatchability. Which movie, which music documentary would you rather...
By the way, you should have a subtitle for this, like The Fugitive The award for most rewatchable film that's been aired on TNT 800 times.
Oh.
The Fugitive Award.
Interesting.
Because I think I've seen The Fugitive about 400 times on TNT, and I watch it every time it's on.
I didn't kill my wife.
I didn't kill my wife. I don't care.
Yeah. And he jumps.
Yeah.
Great movie. So good.
I think it's kind of weird. I mean, obviously, I think I would watch Stop Making Sense. I could just see that, like, being on in the background and I'm doing stuff, because it is a musical concert. It's like a 16 song set list,
right?
And you can just jump in and out at any point, and there's always something interesting going on. So I would say that kind of more memorable moments, because I think that's kind of what defines rewatchability. It's like, oh, this scene's coming up, I want to watch that. It's, you know, obviously different because it's a these are music documentaries and this is a concert documentary,
right?
But I think that one for sure, for me.
I completely agree. And I think what I appreciate about, like, a music documentary, and in this case, like, the concert one, is that you, because so much is going on, you're going to pick up on more now that you have watched it once. So you're like, okay, I don't need to pay attention to what David Burton's doing. I'm going to watch what the drummer's doing. Or, oh, I just watched, like, they slid this out and he was sort of getting amped up, like, without the lights on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jimi Hendrix one was interesting. I would recommend it to people who are not Jimi Hendrix aficionados, because I think they would already know most of the stuff.
I think I'd agree with that. And I was not a Jimi Hendrix aficionado, so I learned a lot of little interesting facts.
Right.
And so it would be a good segue into it. But it was more like a kind of a litany of all of these facts, not connected by anything other than chronology.
Right. It was more of like a History Channel, like, biography
Exactly. It was a straight telling. It's like, I was born in Seattle, Washington. My mom died at 10, and now we're going to go all the way until I die.
Right. And so going into our next criteria, which one did you learn the most? I want to say Jimi Hendrix, because, like, I learned anything, where, like, the whole David Byrne thing, we just sort of learned that he's crazy and, like, very talented, but we sort of knew that ahead of time.
Yeah.
And, like, but I just don't know a lot about Jimi Hendrix, and I knew he started in the UK, and for some reason I just presumed he was British. I don't know why, because he came out of there. I didn't know he started here. I didn't know his roots. And so I learned some from that, and that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know hardly anything about the genesis of his, I think it's safe to say, musical genius.
Yeah.
I mean, I learned he was a self-taught musician. He didn't start playing the guitar till he was like 14 or 15.
Right.
He was, you know, he was with all of these, like, very, like, popular, huge acts
before he became big, but super creative as well.
Yeah. But he was bored by their sound, which I thought was fascinating. And then he goes over to the UK, starts the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and that's where he really takes off. And he said, he's like, the Brits are, like, so demanding. He had to keep putting out music.
Evolving too.
So even though he didn't live very long, he still has a fairly robust catalog.
They said he recorded for 4 years, like, from when Hey Joe, like, took off to when he, you know, aspirated in his own vomit, which, you know, happens to the best of them. Death by misadventure. That's what happened to Bon Scott of AC/DC. But turns out that he was also on, like, 18, like, sleeping pills or something.
Yeah.
So that's not great. Yeah, it's just, like, one of those things where did so much in such little time that you can't start asking what would happen if he's still alive. It's, like, same thing with, like Biggie or Janis Joplin. It's just be, like, too difficult to understand, like, to put them in the rationale of, like the Rolling Stones were so big, and Bob Dylan, like, look where they are now. You're like, Bob Dylan has a Nobel Prize and the Rolling Stones are still touring, and you're like, oh god. Maybe I'm not saying I wanted them to die, just, like, stop making music. Like,
yeah, there's I don't want to steal this idea too much because I've heard it elsewhere, but it's like, where do you maximize, what point in your life do you maximize your, like, cultural significance, and a lot of times it's people who die too young or bands that break up,
right,
and they become revered, as opposed to like U2, who is still touring, and it's like, yeah, but it's, I mean,
it's all to benefit Africa, yeah, though, so sure, I want to get off their
campaign
back.
Red whatever the hell else Bono is doing, and
he's got to get those glasses aren't cheap,
yeah,
okay, he's got to get new glasses.
So I mean so both the Talking Heads and Jimi Hendrix have this like very unique quality and sound, and it, and we don't, and it's kind of encapsulated because they don't make music anymore,
right,
either through death or through choice,
right,
and so that, but you know, in terms of what facts did I learn, obviously there are no facts other than the facts you learn about the individual's personalities and,
mm-hmm,
and stop making sense, but you learn a lot of just kind of biographical information about Jimi Hendrix.
Right. So which one would you say do you learn the most?
Jimi Hendrix.
Okay. Which one did you think did a better job of telling a story or a narrative?
It's interesting because there's no interviews in Stop Making Sense. There aren't. It's just a straight 16-song set list, sort of, but
which
not really.
Which is exhausting.
Yeah.
16 songs.
Yeah. I think it was about an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically what your set would be. Yeah.
Exact same amount. Yeah.
And, but I still think it told a better story. It starts with just David Byrne on a soundstage, basically, with a boombox and an acoustic guitar. And then for like 6 or 7 songs, a new band member joins for every song.
They literally roll them out and connect
yeah,
together.
And so that, I mean, it really is kind of telling the story of the Talking Heads, and you really learn kind of their expressive and artistic qualities through watching this documentary, so to speak, and what they're trying to say and tell you about themselves and their group and their art, and so yeah, I mean, the better story for me, storytelling, definitely Jimi Hendrix tells a story, but it just wasn't as interesting,
right? And I don't even think the documentary wasn't trying to tell the story of Jimi Hendrix,
mm-hmm,
it was just trying to have him talk to you, which I thought was super novel, and like, I don't think I would have had an avenue into that without this. But like you said, it was just sort of like every time he had an opportunity to give us insight that we couldn't get from reading a biography about him, he just sort of shrugged it off. It seemed like his humility or his humility was almost to the point where he just like didn't understand what he was, like what he meant to people and like what he meant to the genre, because he's like, oh, I don't really think I'm that great of a guitar player. We're like, what?
Through this documentary, it's pretty clear he's not, I mean, he's coming to the height of his popularity,
yeah,
in the late 60s, and he's not a political activist at,
right,
all.
Right.
And this documentary doesn't give us any context to what that meant to kind of the culture and to other musicians and how he fit into this. And he really just seemed kind of like a loner, but they kind of just, I mean, he's like, yeah, I'm not really gonna say anything publicly about Vietnam. Although I did some research after this, which will bleed into the next category. And he did say some things about Vietnam,
yeah,
which were pro-war.
No
which,
way.
Yes.
Man, he's just a handful of curveballs, this guy.
But they didn't talk about that, really.
He didn't talk about
it. He didn't talk about
it, which is interesting.
Right. Well, but I think that's where this documentary could have been better if it wasn't so tied to the structure of trying to tell his story through his own words. Like, it needed more third-party commentary to talk about the significance of him with respect to musical culture, with respect to popular culture, and kind of how he fit into all of that in the 60s, I thought would have been really interesting, and it's just not there. And I don't know if you've seen this. This is a more recent than both of these documentary, a year or two ago. There was a documentary called I Am Not Your Negro about James Baldwin.
Oh.
And it's the same kind of structure, which is
like diary entries.
Well, yeah, it's his story is told through him,
mm-hmm,
but there's more of a, it's not trying to tell us the biography of him, kind of like this. There was more of a point that the movie was trying to get across about right. culture and his right. view of culture that was far more effective. But it's the same idea,
right.
but one was done better than the other.
It's just would seem like I would have all this content from the Jimi Hendrix documentary, and I would use it in another documentary to punch it up to be like, okay, so this is what the newspaper was saying, this is what people were saying, this is what he said. Or this would be a great companion documentary where it's like, this is what, you know, Billboard Top 100, this mm-hmm. is what they're saying about it, you know, this is what his fans, this is what, you know, young artists that were influenced by him, this is what old artists who, you know, thought he was crazy, and then this is what he did. But this is just like tepid. Like, I'm not yeah. getting, he doesn't seem happy, he doesn't seem excited, he doesn't yeah. seem interested in his, not just fame, just like what he's doing. And what he was doing was revolutionary. Like,
yeah, this is what we're in early February when we're recording this.
Yeah.
As we've learned in the last couple days, just go ask Quincy Jones, because he will tell you, whatever the hell was going on, he will spill the beans because he's old enough and crazy enough to yeah. do it right now. So it's like, we needed someone like Quincy Jones to come in there and just like start spitting fire about right. what was really going on.
That would be... Yeah, everybody's dead. Yeah. Or they're like acided out, so yeah. they're just like, I don't remember.
Yeah, let me throw this quote at you that I read, okay. that I pulled up and I saved. So this was a quote that Jimi Hendrix gave in an interview in 1967 okay. to a Dutch magazine.
So this is right after Are You Experienced and... So Axis, Bold as Love, and Are You Experienced both came out this year.
Yeah.
That's the context.
So he said, the Americans are fighting in Vietnam for a completely free world. As soon as they move out, they will be at the mercy of the communists. For that matter, the yellow danger, which I guess he was referring to China, should not be underestimated. Of course, war is horrible, but as at present, it is the only guarantee of peace. So not a pacifist That's whatsoever.
Wild.
Yeah. And so very hawkish. Exactly. He was a war hawk. In the late 60s, but he's also part of this countercultural musical movement that defined the generation and the era, yeah. and we don't get really any depth of that in this. He did, obviously, I think he conveyed that he was not politically active, but like that was pretty radical yeah. to be part of this culture right. and to hold those views.
And it's so funny because like the whole him playing at Woodstock and finding out later that like Woodstock wasn't supposed to be like a giant hippie fest. Yeah. It was just like people knocked down the gates and everybody's like, well, we're already here. Yeah. So, and then, so like that wasn't a political. And then when he played the Star Spangled Banner, he's like, I don't get it. Like, why are you guys?
Yeah.
This is just, I played it real good.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, like the bombs, man. Like you hate America. He's like, is that, no, that's not, that's what you got out of it? No, I was playing my guitar and then it just sort of got lost in there.
That's what I was saying. I mean, the one thing, my big takeaway is Jimi Hendrix was definitely this very introspective, to a degree, loner,
mm-hmm.
just really caught up in his own music and just wanted to play whatever he wanted to play.
Right.
And it was definitely for him first, which is, I mean, I respect, but, and yeah. so.
Like what Prince ended up doing with like, what's the name of Prince's studio? Something purple. I can't remember.
Probably. I'm just trusting you on this one.
You don't know this? I'll look it up later. And it's sort of like, or what like Kanye West is now doing with like how he co-signs everybody he thinks is good and then they end up like doing really well. It's sort of, he set up Electric Ladyland, which is, you know, his studio, and he was putting people through that.
Well, the internet tells me it is Paisley Park Records.
Paisley.
Not purple.
Dang. I knew it had something to do with his fashion.
Yeah.
So, okay. But so that was, you know, that's sort of how he's going to perpetuate the sounds that he wants to hear in music. And that, like, we sort of have to read into it because he just didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Or I guess to his dad or whatever.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, that's where they got the letters. So, okay, our last one. Now that we've watched both, which artist or group would you want to revisit, either their music catalog or just like learn more about because you've been sufficiently tantalized by either of these documentaries?
Again, for me, it was Stop Making Sense. And
me too.
And I've already done this since I watched it. I was like, I wanted to know why they don't tour.
Yeah.
I found out a lot of stuff about David Byrne's a real asshole, which is really the one reason, because he does not want to. He said it would be like taking several steps back in his like creative evolution.
Oh boy!
And it was like one of the things I read. It was like, why would we do that? We would just sound the same. And it was like, yeah, that's the point.
Everybody,
people want to hear the Talking Heads, the peak of the, they want to hear the Stop Making Sense set list.
Right.
I would, you know. Billy Joel is touring, it seems like, every damn year. It's like, can we get a Talking Heads tour once every 5 years?
No, never. That's interesting. I definitely picked them as well because, again, like, all the songs I knew by Jimi Hendrix, they mentioned, they didn't really talk about, he doesn't really talk about his back catalog. He doesn't, you know, 4 years, but he kicked out a bunch of music. And then the Talking Heads, it's just sort of like, if you're into this sound, we've got a whole bunch of other stuff that you might be into, but it might not sound the same. So, and then again, where did they come up with this concept? What fuels them? Why were they interested in this? Like, does he always wear a suit? Like, why do they have people from Funkadelic? Like, it just seems like I was so interested in like his stage presence and what he was putting forward for everybody. I don't really know if we were allowed to interpret too much because he was pretty straightforward about everything, but just like, he sort of like did slapstick up there, and then he like, the whole idea of building the set, building the band, starting with just him and an acoustic guitar, that's like, I want to understand why he thinks that's the story he wants to tell. I don't know. Plus, like, I want to hear more of their music now from after this period, and sort of like, I think they were called the Artistics. Was that their original name?
I don't know. Okay. I'll trust you.
I'll look that up.
I believe it, though.
Not to say that Jimi Hendrix isn't a fascinating figure. I just don't want to be bored by a person who's so interesting to me. And I'm worried that we're going to just find out like, oh, yeah, like he just loved doing drugs. Like, oh, that's too bad. It's like he wrote.
I can't remember. Maybe you do. That he had a couple quotes from his diaries or postcards or letters that referenced drug use, mm-hmm. which kind of made my ears perk up because I was like, well, that's interesting. He almost had this like, it wasn't like a prophecy that he would die young, but there were these things that almost alluded to like, you know, I don't, you know, in his, when he was in his late 20s and actually I don't know, how old was he?
27. He was 20, part of that group.
Yeah. So he kind of made these kind of allusions almost that end up being prophetic, which I obviously don't think they were meant to be at the time, about drug use. And it's referenced a couple times in there about his experiments with drugs. Mm-hmm. So,
no, I think he talked about like foreshadowing, smoking weed or like casually. And he's just like, yeah, some of that stuff. He never talked about it explicitly. I mean, like would talk about like drinking sometimes, but yeah, I don't think he wasn't like, you know, the modern day people who like just talk about how much like codeine they drink. That wasn't really part of the zeitgeist back then, even though he was like revolutionizing what it was to be like. And then, you know, the whole like fly your freak flag, like that could mean not just doing drugs either.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like kiss the sky, like we all know what that means, right? Like I looked it up on Urban Dictionary. I know what it means.
Does that he know what it means? It's got to be true. People voted on it.
Did he take it? Like, did he already know what it was? Or, like, that sort of stuff? I want to know this stuff. Just, like, stupid questions or important questions. But I'm also worried that, like, we're going to find out when he wrote Castles Made of Sand, it's because he was, like, at a beach and he watched somebody make a castle of sand. And it's like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, the whole Cat Stevens, like, peace train thing. He's like, well, I was on a train. I was thinking about peace. You're like... Damn.
I'm pretty sure it's Yusuf Islam now.
Oh, but you can't fly on planes anymore, poor guy.
I think, yeah, that's...
I don't even know if they would want him. We take all. Well, maybe not this crazy guy.
Yeah.
All right, so those were our criteria. In sort of a landslide, Stop Making Sense is the music documentary we would tell you to watch if you had the choice between that and Jimi Hendrix Voodoo Child streaming on Netflix. Although we both had, like, Stop Making Sense was a little harder to get your hands on. You had to, like, buy it or, like, rent it.
Yeah, I rented it on iTunes.
Yeah, so it's, but I would say it's worth it. It was really interesting. You can rewatch it. You don't learn too much, but you want to afterwards. And it has a very compelling story.
Yeah, they stayed together for, what, 7 more years after this came out?
So. Yeah, and where they come from.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're going to come back in just a moment with a recommendation of a music documentary that we did not watch. All right, we're back. This is the recommendation section? Yeah, that sounds good. Of the podcast episode, where we're going to tell you a music documentary that you would really enjoy watching that was not Stop Making Sense or Jimi Hendrix Voodoo Child. So, Andrew, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
You go ahead and start, since okay. I did not know this was part of this, so yeah. I have to I'm you know, trying to rattle my brain for a good recommendation.
Yeah, it's hard to come up with like a good one that you feel comfortable with describing, because I'm assuming you haven't watched one recently. So I picked Some Kind of Monster, the story of like Metallica's recording of Saint Anger, which was came out in, so they recorded it from 2001 to 2003, and the documentarians followed them around, and the director shot 1,200 hours of footage, and it turned into a 2-hour, 21-minute documentary, which was also on the list of music documentaries you should see. And I watched it, and I'm pretty sure, so this came out after Saint Anger, and I think Saint Anger was the first like Metallica album that I like bought and listened to all the way through, and then I went back to their like older catalog. But it was a very divisive album for their fans. Like, first of all, Metallica fans are just very angry most of the time. And turns out they were very angry that they decided to change some of their sound. Album, Saint Anger, came with an accompanying DVD that had the whole album shot in studio. It was just like handy cam of like them recording song
it's
after song.
It's just Lars being angry and yelling
James,
at people.
Mr. Hetfield.
Yeah.
So that's like the accompanying DVD that came with it. And then this movie followed them like screaming at each other, like, you know. And it was also the majority of the movie, not the majority, like there's over an hour of like a film of them in like group therapy with a psychiatrist. And you're just like, what's going on? Like James Hetfield has his legs crossed in a leather chair, and he's just takes his glasses off, and he's like, let's talk about my feelings. And you're like, what's going on? These are the guys who did like Master of Puppets and like, you know, Kill Everybody. That's not the, I don't remember the name of the song, but like they're just very angry, and it's just, this is what happens when you become a mature adult. You actually talk about your feelings, and you, I really liked Saint Anger, but I'm also like, I got into them late, and I'm not into screamo because I'm more like, I prefer more like rock and roll to anger scream, like what, death metal, that's also a thing. All this stuff is too much for me. But so like, and this movie was eye-opening. It made me want to revisit like the catalog and their story as a band. I would definitely watch it again, and I learned so much. Like it was a great music documentary.
I think the depth of my Metallica fandom mm-hmm. begins and ends with Inner Sandman.
Great
and,
song.
And that's about it.
Great song.
I would watch a documentary about the making of that music video.
Yeah.
What where that like that semi is like breaking through shit. But I will definitely give that one a try.
It's 2 hours and 21 minutes. So, like,
it up. What I'm going to recommend is, similarly, what I recall of it was god-awful long, but interesting elements.
Okay.
And some symmetry here to what the documentaries we talked about. But there was a Kurt Cobain documentary that was produced by Courtney Love that came out 3 years ago. I had to look up the title.
Something with bleach.
It was Montage of Heck.
Oh, okay.
It was called Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck. But similar to the Jimi Hendrix documentary, it's told largely through home footage from the time, and kind of walks through the life of Kurt Cobain growing up in Washington, through his, again, untimely death,
right,
and kind of his struggle with addiction. And there's a part where they talk about the kind of go through with the towards the very end, that kind of iconic. I remember this. I'm old enough to remember MTV Unplugged. I'm old enough to remember when there were music videos on MTV and I would just watch them. But in kind of the MTV Unplugged, kind of like the peak of kind of his powers as a musician and that sound.
Right.
And so that's my recommendation. But this, I had to look because I just remembered it was long. It is really long. It is 2 hours and 25 minutes long. So, again, be prepared. And the internet tells me it was bought or purchased for distribution by HBO, so that should be readily available too.
What I thought was really interesting about, like, diving into this was the whole, like, just saying it's a music documentary could mean, like, three or four different, very different things. Like, concert, DVD, this was not. Traditional documentary, it was not either. But yeah, I guess like the whole thing with like you have to have like a full estate sort of like okay it, or like a documentarian say like, yes, I'm going to follow you around. I just assume that people at that level can control their own narrative so much that a true documentary would probably be a little difficult in the consideration of like, you know, like a Food Inc. or something like that. We're like, we're going to expose Jimi Hendrix. And he's just like, nope, too many, like you said, too many lawyers.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
And one thing that I think maybe we find most interesting, or one thing that in some of these movies that we liked versus ones we liked a little less,
right,
is that when these documentaries hit like the zenith of these artists, it's very cool. So I think we saw kind of like the zenith of Talking Heads.
Right.
Maybe what the documentary about Metallica kind of sounds like that was at their peak. And that's kind of what was missing from Jimi Hendrix, is there weren't very many peaks and valleys to really speak of.
Yeah, he didn't really seem to care. He's just like, I have enough money for, like, I can live comfortably.
In the UK. Yeah, he died in the UK. It sounded like he had kind of left the United States. It really wasn't his scene.
Right. All right, so those are two recommendations for you. So this is like the plugs section. Andrew, do you want to tell people how they can follow you on social media?
No, not really, because it's all secure at the moment.
Oh, that's fine. A lot of people,
I no longer have Facebook, so I'm like you.
Yeah.
I guess you can follow me on Snapchat, so you can go your route.
Although, Oh, yeah.
Yes, I have an Instagram account for my dog. It is instagram.com/gooddogSadie, where you can find pictures of me and my dog Sadie.
There you go. Truth in advertising. I appreciate that. Yeah, no, Snapchat just like had a new update. Now I'm like totally lost on how to use it. So
I heard that. I did it today, but I have not been on there.
A little frightened.
Okay.
There's a lot of strangers on there. And it says that they're popular.
It's a strange world. I did not know who Logan Paul was until he apparently went to some forest where people commit suicide in Japan.
Yeah.
And I was happy not knowing who he was, so I hope they're not promoting stuff like that.
I don't think so, but I know Tide Pods are on the rise right now. Yeah. Although, I guess it, like,
I hear they're delicious.
When you hear this in, like, March, it's going to be, like, over, and we're going to sound stupid. We really dated ourselves in the Tide Pod reference. It's like a bad episode of SNL. Okay, so this has been Comparing Apples to Oranges, where we take two things. This time it was music documentaries, and we decided that the Talking Head Stop Making Sense from 1984 was better than the Jimi Hendrix Voodoo Child from 2010. So this has been a great time. This is Mike.
And this is Andrew. Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you next time, guys. Bye. Hey there. Thanks for listening to podcast episode number 24. I hope you like this one. Look us up. We're on Tumblr, comparing apples to oranges, all one word, .tumblr.com. That's where all the links for co-hosts and info about past episodes will be. If you have comments or ideas for future episodes of the podcast, send them to Twitter. It's at the Cato Podcast, all one word, or email us at catopodcast@gmail.com. Our music bed music, also our intro and outro stuff, was from Leisure B. His track was named Thumbs Up. If you liked it and want to check more stuff out, go to humanworkshop.com to look up his music. Okay, bye everybody.